This is an interview with Jean Gleason-Stromberg for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas, and the date is November 7th, 2013. We are in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for speaking with us today. We usually start by discussing a little bit of personal background, where you came from, what you studied in college, and so forth, what your parents did, if it's relevant to where you ended up.
I grew up in California, in Palo Alto, where my family had Stanford relationships, and so I rebelled and went to college in the East at Wellesley, and more or less have stayed in the East since then. I've already forgotten the rest of what the question was. My parents didn't have anything. My family, by and large, the men were mostly doctors. Nobody was a lawyer. I guess that was part of my rebellion, too. I decided to go to law school, mostly because I liked going to school, not because I particularly wanted to go to law school.
Was there anything in particular that attracted you to Wellesley?
Yes. In those days, this is in the 1960s, there were women's schools, and Stanford is, and Wellesley had a beautiful campus. I can't tell you that it was more.
Right.
It was the way most people make their decisions about where they go.
So. And you studied history there.
And I studied history, yeah, mostly American history.
Okay. And then you went to Harvard Law. Finished in 1965 at Wellesley?
Yeah. Yes. And then what I really wanted to do was go get a PhD in American Studies, but I didn't want to teach, so I was advised I should not do that. And so law school seemed, there it was.
Okay. How was your experience there?
It was fine. I think in a lot of ways there were about 20 women in the class out of 550 or so. But I think having gone to a women's school, it was easier to adjust to that than it might have been if I'd gone to a co-ed school. And then I got married the first year. I took Louis Loss's securities course, but I had no particular interest in any particular kind of law.
Right.
Or law generally at that point. But I liked law school.
Okay. So then tell me about what happened when you finished. You did go into law, in fact.
Yes, I think it wasn't very imaginative. I clerked for a year on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The judge didn't realize I was a woman from my name and the fact that my voice is a little, could go either way sometimes. So he was surprised when I showed up, and he had already hired a woman clerk who was the first woman clerk. So he had two. So we had a wonderful time, and we all had a good time. He was very nice too. And it was during that time that I think all of the Ninth Circuit was in San Francisco, and except for a few judges in Los Angeles, and the judges all went out to lunch together every day. They were all men. And Judge Hufstedler was appointed from, she was appointed a judge, and she was in Los Angeles, but she would come up to San Francisco. And when she came up for a few days, the other judges would stop going out to lunch because they didn't know what to do with her. They didn't want to. It upset their system. So she would have lunch with me and the other woman clerk, and so we had a great time. Then I don't know how much you're interested in the woman part.
Oh, we're absolutely interested.
When I first got out of law school, law firms weren't hiring women by and large, and then the next year, which was 1969, many of them had discovered that they should have, well, actually that the Civil Rights Act applied to them too, which was passed in 1965. But so the next year, a number of them offered me a job as their first woman, and they were, I chose the firm that had the reputation for being the least collegial, because I thought that way I wouldn't be left out, because it was clear that the collegiality had, several of the more firms told me that they didn't want to hire women because the guys liked to swear and have a good time, and they were afraid it would inhibit them if there were a woman around. So those were the collegial firms. So I thought, well, I'll go the one where they don't particularly like each other. Then I won't take it so seriously, you know, personally. And it was fine. It was just such a different time that it's sort of hard to imagine now.
Yeah, there was a strong, would you say that it was more antagonistic or more professional, being the opposite of collegiality?
No, it was just slightly, it was, you were less likely to take personally if somebody was unpleasant to you, or have a feeling, as sometimes you might as a woman, that everybody else was doing something and you were the only one left out.
Right, I see.
Was a tendency. Or, as I was saying about the judge, the judges, you know, the men, the male judges, just, it wasn't that they didn't like the woman judge, or they just were uncomfortable. They didn't, it interrupted their pattern of having lunch together and hanging out to have a woman join them. It was just a different world. And that was sort of what I was trying to, I mean, it was sort of a silly reason, I admit, but, and when I first got to that firm, the head of the antitrust litigation, who, the only time he ever spoke to me, said, "This is a rough, tough firm, and you have to be rough and tough to survive in it."
It wasn't so often overtly rude then.
No. Yeah. He was unpleasant, particularly. Yeah. He was unpleasant, but he was unpleasant to everybody. No, it wasn't. Once I was there, it was fine. And I got put in the securities group because one of the younger partners had advised me that I should say I was really interested in something so that I would sound more focused than I was. And he said, you know, securities would be a great area for women. He said, there's a lot of detail work. That would. So I said, I'll do securities. But not with him. I was smart enough to say I'd rather work with somebody else. So I worked with a bunch of nice people who were sort of old school gentleman types that securities then was, in a lot of ways, the securities law practice and the securities on Wall Street and, you know, investment banking. They were really gentlemen's things, and I mean that in not a negative way. I mean, they were all men, but they were also sort of went by gentlemen's. They worked together well, and they understood the rules. People.
So what sort of work were you doing, and what sort of cases were you involved in?
I wasn't doing cases. I was doing counseling work, which is what securities law used to mostly be. You know, just working on corporate things and registration statements and things like that.
Compliance, essentially?
Nobody ever said the word compliance in those days. I mean, that just wasn't a concept. It was such a different era. And I'm sorry that it's changed so much, because it was more a, people wanted, the SEC had control over their registration statement and making it.
Okay.
So securities lawyers in those days were, they were kind of the gatekeepers for people who wanted to raise money. And everybody understood that, and the clients treated the securities lawyers as people who had to be listened to. They had a lot of power, the lawyers did, because they could say, if you don't disclose what I'm recommending, the SEC won't, you know, they won't let your registration statement go effective. It was all in the Division of Corporation Finance that everybody was actually doing all the work. And it was a very everybody sort of was on the same wavelength about it. It was a very effective system. There were enough rules that the lawyer had something to point to, and the SEC was, its existence and the fact that it was paying attention gave the lawyers some backbone to be able to say no to the clients about things. And everybody was in the same situation, and it was the old days when law was more of a profession and the clients listened. But it was also the enforcement division was, there wasn't even an enforcement division for many years because enforcement just wasn't as important because it was for the aberrant people, not for the regular sort of people who were all had lawyers who, and there used to be this saying, if one securities lawyer says something needs to be disclosed, that all securities lawyers would say that. That everybody would see it the same way. And that's partly because they got together a lot and they knew each other, but it was just, it was a very different place. So the SEC, the main emphasis in a lot of ways was on helping people comply with the law. But we never used the term compliance because it was more everybody just wanted to do the right thing. It wasn't, and the right thing was relatively clear.
Right, what was prescribed by the law, essentially.
Well, and but of course, a lot of what was prescribed was, you know, materiality, and that's a judgment call in a lot of ways. And but the lawyers had a lot of power over helping decide what was material and what needed to be disclosed. And they knew they'd have the backup of the SEC if they, I mean, not the enforcement people, but the people in corporation finance.
So had you intended on staying out in California then, or had that just been a place that you'd gone to?
Well, I was from there. My then husband was, like, he was working in a law firm in San Francisco, and then he decided, I never really had pictured myself as practicing law. I didn't actually know what it was. And we had worked in Washington one summer.
During law school.
And he had a chance to come work at EPA when it was first starting up, and he was interested in that, and it was fine with me to move back here.
Okay. Why don't we talk then a little bit about, you moved to the SEC then after that, correct?
I came back
72?
Here without a job. And again, it was a time when they were looking for women in a lot of the agencies. First job offer I got was from the ICI, the Investment Company Institute, which I had never heard of, but I knew somebody who knew something, and I went and talked to them. And they had always had, they had a slot for a woman, which was their blue sky slot, and she was leaving, so they wanted somebody new. Dave Silver and some of the old investment company people were there then. That was the first time I heard of the Investment Company Act. And then I talked to just people who put me in touch with other people at different agencies. And I can't remember why I went to the SEC to interview, but I interviewed Brad Cook was then the general counsel, and Harvey Pitt was in that office, and so I interviewed them, and Harvey said that you needed to take a written test if you were going to be in there. They offered me a job but said I had to take this test, and I said, I've been practicing law for 3.5 years. I'm not going to take some test. So Alan Levinson happened to be coming by Brad Cook's office at that point. And Brad said to Alan, you know, here's somebody you might be interested in. So Alan looked at my resume and interviewed me and offered me a job in Corp Fin. And it was the only job offer I got where nobody said, we want you because you're a woman. and it was the lowest offer I got, but I thought, okay, I can do this, and I've been sort of doing corporate law, so, and I liked, so I said, okay, I'll do that.
Okay, what did the work in CorpFin then entail?
Well, I started in a branch as a staff attorney, and that branch was specializing in real estate. It was when REITs were first coming out, and other real estate kinds of products, unusual things for those days. And during that time, there was a big study that Ray Dickey did on for the commission on, there was a group on real estate securities and real estate and securities law, which I happen to have a copy of right there. And I worked on that, and then and that was after 6 months or so, I worked in the Office of Disclosure Policy, and which was more working on rules and policies, and then I continued doing that, really, but I was counsel, special counsel to the director. So I was more involved in the... I got to see what the branch work was like and do that, which I... it is actually quite satisfying, could be quite satisfying. And then it was an era when... they had just written Rule 144. There was a lot of emphasis on private placements and worries about how to do it in those days, and, mm-hmm. and they just done Rule 144, and which had to do with reselling securities that you bought in a private placement.
That was the safe harbor?
A safe harbor. And then I worked on 145, 146, and 147. 145 was mergers, and 146 was what became Reg D at some point, and now it was a private placement. It was the first rule on trying to spell out a safe harbor for private placements. And then 147 was interstate offerings, trying to spell out a safe harbor for...
Okay.
So that was a very exciting... That was a lot of fun, and I did a lot of the first drafts of those. And then I got to work with, Alan and Dick Rowe and Neil McCoy on getting them to fruition. And then I did a fair amount of speaking, trying to explain them to the world at PLI conferences and things, when people listened gratefully. And then I also worked on the first, that was when they had hearings on disclosure of future-oriented information. Mm-hmm. You hadn't been able to put anything, projections, in any documents. And so we had big hearings on that and wrote up some ways you could try and do that, including developing management's discussion and analysis, which was the first time that was required. And I worked a lot with Sandy Burton, who was then the chief accountant, on that, and he was quite a wonderful person and a very good accountant at being able to explain to non-accountants what was happening.
The whole idea of a safe harbor was very novel at that time. So, I mean, was that from a commission standpoint? Was there a lot of discussion?
No, this was Alan Levinson's sort of vision, I think. And, no, actually, you want
to... Sure. Okay, so you've just found a document from April 1974, or a document, it's a poem, really. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, in CorpFin, we did a lot of work on the safe harbor rules that we called the 140 series. And Ray Garrett was then the chairman of the commission, and he had practiced securities law for a long time, and he was interested. He and Al Sommer, who was also on the commission, were interested in this part of the securities law, i.e., trying to help people comply as opposed to enforcement. And so, after we had gotten a lot of these rules out, Ray wrote a poem that he gave us to thank us. I guess he was thanking us. It was called Ode to the Word Series. The division of Corp Fin has long had the drearies slogging its way through the 140 series. We all raise our glasses now that it's done to Dick, Neil, Gene, and Al Levinson. With 144, we carved a new door. With 145, mergers will thrive. With 147, there's no intrastate heaven, but we get the most kicks from 146. Now that it's finished, we can all look ahead to years of interps to explain what we said. And we've well taught the bar an eternal verity. By the time we get through, there's no charity in clarity.
It's a nice poem.
It kind of summarizes what we were, the attitude of what we were trying to do in that period.
It's my understanding that these new rules actually really did very nicely streamline things for the people in Corp Fin.
Well, I think they did for the people in Corp Fin. I think they did for private practice, too. I mean, they didn't exactly streamline them, but they gave them something to work with so that they, again, could tell their clients, well, here's what the rule says, so we'll do it that way. I mean, this is where, like, 146 is where the concept of the... that's still around today, of the investor having to meet certain standards, and a lot of the concepts got chipped off over the years until today, where there's hardly anything left, because now you can sell to anybody anytime, it looks like. But it gave a structure that I think was very useful.
Okay. Should we talk about anything else in your time in Corp Fin? Because I know you moved then to investment management.
Well, the other thing that was going on in Corp Fin then was Stanley Sporkin was then head of enforcement, which was a fairly new division, and that was when it was before the Foreign Corrupt Series Act, and when Stanley first got excited about payments, political payments by corporations. And so for quite, I'm sure there are other discussions of this, but Alan, Stanley wanted to sue everybody, and that was not, would not have been efficient, and there would have been a lot too many people. And Alan developed this, Alan and Stanley together developed this concept of people coming in and this voluntary thing where they'd come in and tell you what they'd done and who they'd paid money to, and we'd make them disclose something about it, and but they wouldn't get sued, by and large. And we had many, many meetings with general counsels of big companies and their outside lawyers, and Stanley and his enforcement people, and where they would kind of report to us what they had found. You know, they'd have internal investigations and. It was a different way of it was efficient, and then the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act evolved out of that, was adopted after that, because there really hadn't been any law against what they were doing. It was just we were hanging on disclosure things that they needed to disclose it to, so people would understand that their business was dependent on something, you know, potentially illegal. Or It wasn't until the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act actually passed and was adopted that that became the law itself. But it was a very busy time, and I was a little less sympathetic with Stanley's point of view than with Alan's. It was certainly an interesting time.
You've reminded me, actually, that I think another issue in this period was proxy statements and what had to be in them and what could be left out. Did you run into that?
Oh, you mean like shareholder proposals?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that was something else that we worked on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You had
it was a great time.
Yeah, you were a special counsel to the director, so you had
I got to
sight.
You do a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah, everything across the whole division.
I spent a lot of time writing speeches sometime for the commissioners and the chairman who were giving speeches about these topics that they had to, and writing the rules, but also just sitting around and talking about the concepts and stuff. So it was really fun.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity to do some of that original writing falling down to the staff.
That's where it always is.
Yeah. But to what extent, then, would there be discussions with... I mean, you mentioned commissioners and also...
Well, we didn't discuss it with commissioners, but we... Alan, who was the director, had a way of managing where he would invite in everybody who had a... like, if we were talking about one of these rules, he would... And we'd sit around with Dick Rowe and Neil, who was the chief counsel then, and Mickey Beach sometimes, although less often. She would sit. And we would just talk, you know, go through. They'd read the drafts, and we'd brainstorm about things. And Alan would make the final decisions, but he always wanted to hear what everybody had to say first. It was a good way of operating.
That was very interesting. I was talking a couple months ago now with Peter Romeo, so he got another perspective on not a contrasting perspective, but it's interesting.
The other thing that was going on there, when I mentioned real estate, that was that was kind of the first alternative product thing that everybody talks about today. But so there were a lot of developments during that time. Condominiums were new, and there was questions arose whether condominiums that were sold with rental pools, you know, like where you develop a resort condominium and then you could, the developers would then say they'd rent back, you know, they'd rent out the condominiums when you weren't there and you'd make some money from it. Well, it was a big thing about whether those were securities and which they were, and there was a lot of effort put into trying to deal with changes in the real estate. And I, that was sort of my expertise too, and I do have this vivid memory of being sent to the American Association of Land Developers meeting in Colorado to give a speech on how the securities laws applies to condominiums. And as I said to Alan at the time, I'm being sent because I'm a woman, and this way they won't pick on me so much. I had to explain to them that all the things they were doing, potentially they had, not only were they selling securities, but then all their salesmen would have to be broker-dealers and the like. And then Reg T, which was then the margin rules, might apply to their mortgages. And we lay out this long string. It was very funny. They were very polite to me.
Yes.
There was a lot going on then.
So were there issues then in getting them to, I'm a little reluctant to say comply now because you mentioned we didn't.
Well, they adjusted the lawyers were all interested in how to set them up in the right way. There were a lot of no action letters from, you know, about how to do it and when not to do it. A lot of them did register their condominium developments for a long time. I don't know what's happened now. I'm sure nobody does anything now, so.
It was all very novel to them, being part of the securities ambit.
Well, condominiums were pretty new themselves, but at least the resort condominium concept.
Okay, should we talk about the investment management division then?
Yes, what happened there is that the disclosure part of investment management, i.e. mutual funds, their registrations and things, were reviewed in the Division of Corporation Finance, and they had been, at one time, both the registration, the disclosure aspects, and the regulatory aspects, because the Investment Company Act actually is a regulatory statute, unlike the Securities Act. They had all been in one division for a while, but then there was concern that they were in the top ranks. I think Rod Hills was chairman then. There had been concern that they were using disclosure to regulate, which was not what they were supposed to be doing. So they had moved, Rod Hills wasn't chair then, because they had, before I got to the commission, they had moved the disclosure part of investment management to CorpFin so that they would, the people doing the regulation in investment management would not be able to use disclosure. So when then Rod Hills was chair and he wanted to move disclosure back to investment management, which was where it should be, and I was offered the job of being the associate director, then because of my background in disclosure, I really went with the disclosure branches. There were three or four branches that got transferred over to investment management. So that was, I knew nothing about the Investment Company Act, so my role was to be the disclosure person who kept them in line. So there were two associate directors, and Ann Jones was then the director, and she was one. I mean, there had only been a few women there when in professional roles when I got there. Ann was one of them. It was interesting to work. It was interesting to learn something new.
Yeah, you ultimately developed quite an expertise in this area. Is that right?
I would not say that. I would say what I did was get the Investment Company Act is very it's not that complex really, but most securities lawyers, it's a specialized area, and most securities lawyers in those days anyway, and probably today, don't actually know anything about it. And what I did was get, and they don't even listen when if you start to talk about it. So I got over the threshold of being afraid of it. I never really learned it, all the ins and outs of it, because I didn't have to and I didn't really want to. So I would say I was not an expert in it, but I certainly was familiar with it.
Okay. And so you did that...
Not afraid of it.
Right. So you did that from 1975 to 1978, I guess.
Yeah.
It says here.
75 or 76, I forget. It was about 2 years.
Okay. And so... could you tell me, I guess, a little bit about the day-to-day of that, maybe?
Well, I oversaw the disclosure branches, and I oversaw the chief counsel's office in investment management, and which did all the interpretations. And the other associate director, Sid Mendelson, oversaw the regulatory aspects, the exemptive requests and things like that. And Ann Jones, the director, was interested in developing some new rules that acknowledged reality, I would say. And so we worked a fair amount on what became Rule 12b-1, which allowed funds to pay for distribution to some under limited circumstances, and that was a big, very big deal in the investment management business. And I think 28E was right around that time too, which was soft dollars. So I worked on those sort of in the same way. I was involved in drafting some stuff, and then overseeing and talking with the chief counsel. And I hired Lee Spencer to become the chief counsel, and he went on to become the director of CorpFin. And it was a good group.
Was it all mutual funds, or were there other areas falling under that?
Investment management was investment advisors and investment companies. So it was the there's an Investment Advisors Act of 1940 and an, the Investment Company Act of 1940. And I think the Public Utility Holding Company was also in that division then, but it was so specialized that none of us knew anything about it. Or somebody did, but I didn't. So it was mostly, it was people, and the legal issues, another big legal issue was people trying to avoid being in the Investment Company Act, being under it. And during that time, we tried to get some legislation that would regulate investment advisors more, but it didn't. Nobody was interested. All you to be an investment advisor, all you had to do was fill out a little form.
Right.
Say you were one, and I remember there was a Sears rug salesman, you know, relevant experience, sold rugs at Sears. You couldn't do anything about it. I mean, that was...
Yeah. Did they generally prefer to only have to, I guess, be in the area of being a broker-dealer or something like that?
Instead of investment company?
Yeah, instead of being an advisor, per se.
Oh, no, being an advisor was much easier.
It's preferable.
Yeah, you know, everybody wanted to be an advisor, but nobody wanted to be an investment company because an investment company was public. You know, it had to be regulated like mutual funds. That's
right.
What it was, basically.
And I know that the big ballooning in mutual funds is generally considered to be in the 1980s, but was there evidence that it was going to be
big business then.
Yeah.
The same people were around. I mean, I still go to things and see people I knew 40 years ago from. It's a very small community of lawyers and advisors.
Okay. And so then from there you went into private practice for quite some time.
Yes. Alan Levinson, who I'd worked with, had gone to Fulbright and Jaworski a couple of years before, right around the time that I went to investment management. And he encouraged me to come there, and I was ready to try something else. I would say this to Stanley's face, and I have. I disagreed with Stanley on a lot of things, and it was getting too... Stanley would say I was being legalistic because I would ask where the law was. we got along fine, but things were just going a direction I was ready to just leave.
Right. So you actually did have to have quite a bit of dealing then on the enforcement side with Stanley.
Well, that was particularly through the foreign court practice, you know, the era when we worked together on the political payments, the things leading up to the foreign court practices.
Right. So you'd have to liaise then about what rules were being violated, I guess.
Not really. He took the lead.
Right.
And then we would say, what's the basis? And then we would have a discussion. He thought he was very good, and I admire him, especially for the political payments part, to do what I wish the commission did more now, and that is use disclosure to affect behavior in some way. But so I wasn't against it. It was just time. You know, I'd been there long enough.
Right.
It was time to...
Okay, so then tell me a little bit about, I guess, the culture at the firm, what your experiences were going over to private practice.
Let me go back and say, because
yeah,
you
absolutely.
Asked about women things, and I was thinking, one of the things, I had my first child when I was in Corp Fin, and when I came back to work, I realized I really wanted to work part-time, and... I said I would work 5 days a week, 80%, so that I felt I could leave when I wanted to go instead of feeling like I had to be there all the time, which was really more for me than it was for them, because everybody said, well, just don't cause problems, just go home. And I said, no, it has to, I'm on an official, so I don't feel like I have to.
At the SEC?
At the SEC. And the personnel office said, well, it can't be done, you know, everybody don't want to do it, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I said, well, I'm going to have to think about whether I want to stay. And Alan, to his great credit, developed. He didn't want to make an exception for me, so he developed the first program to allow part-time work. He put out a release saying anybody in the division can apply for it, male or female. He was very, wanted to be sure it was totally open. It had to meet some standards like 5 days a week and 80%. But and of course, so I did that. The personnel finally, it was also a time when the civil service was starting to encourage some part-time, the government to do that more. But I was very, I was pleased that that it worked and that it was official. And I felt as if I contributed to the future, because the SEC has always had very good women in, and one of the reasons was that I think that there was some flexibility for a while anyway. Anyway, I was going back to the woman.
No, that's
thing
absolutely
that you
fine.
You said you were interested in.
I'm kind of curious. So basically, you had then just a few extra hours of your day to attend to family matters. Then I guess.
Yeah, well, it just took the pressure off me to feel like I had to stay all day and then get home late and whatever. I had full time help at home, but I wanted to be there more. So.
Yeah.
And when I went to Fulbright, that was my deal with them too, was that I would work 5 days a week, but not part time. I got paid part time. It
right.
was a great deal for them, and so was. Because, of course, you end up doing working most of the time. But made me feel better. So when I went to Fulbright, not only was I pregnant with my second child, but I also wanted to work part-time. So I think Alan saw that as a great challenge. He had a good time making that happen. So I did securities law there. We did mostly more special project kind of work. Counseling. It was all, at the beginning, it was almost all counseling. It gradually shifted to more enforcement, but I stayed pretty much in the counseling side.
Did you notice any evolution through time in terms of the issues that one had to deal with in counseling?
Well, I think the role of the lawyer got less. I mean, the power of the lawyer got less. Especially the deregulation that started in the 80s and continued, I thought was not a good thing. But it undercut the power of accountants and lawyers and others, because they, and even boards of directors, that you, my idea. Observation is that you need backbone to do those things, and to expect everybody to have backbone without some backup is just unrealistic. I mean, the pressures of, and the clients got more and more demanding about, you know, they wanted the right answer. They wanted you to tell them how to do it, not what the problems were, which sounds good, but in securities law actually is not so good. And investment banking changed, the whole concept of due diligence. The investment bankers had always taken that really seriously. Then as we moved through the disclosure process of having registration statements, that you became less easier to do shelf registrations that allowed you to file one and then just at some point decide you want to do it. The due diligence part, especially on the investment banker side, started to become much less of a serious business. And that proceeded through that time. And by the 90s, it was, I just wasn't very comfortable. I mean, I had a couple of really good clients I worked for, and I was comfortable with them. But and it was the changes in law firms, too, that, and the clients, so that they would say, well, if I don't get the answer from you, I'll go to somebody else. And they could get a different answer, which they had not, they couldn't have done so much in the 70s and in the early 80s.
It's a real shift away from that culture that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. That is the reason, I think, what you'll find. So many people who worked at the commission in the 70s and have these wonderful positive memories. You really did feel you were doing something in the public interest, in the shareholders' interest or whatever. My friends laughed at me because they were all working for environmental organizations and things where they said, we're doing something in the public interest. But you really could believe it then. I think it's gotten harder. And there was this shift toward enforcement as being the main emphasis, which is not, again, in my view, not a very efficient way to run a regulatory agency, because you just can't. You can't sue everybody. And people, you know, to an extent, it deters people, but not nearly enough.
You'd say then that this attempt to encourage self-reporting then kind of fell apart in that same era?
Oh, it was over by then, because that was only on political payments, payments and stuff that was focused on. Once the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed, that was it was less of an issue.
Would you say then that the shifts that we're talking about were perhaps even more cultural than they were regulatory in terms of the letter of the law?
Well, I think they were related because the regulations were also getting less, you know, more and more wide open, and it became easier to register, so that the power of corporation finance to help people comply became less in a way, and the lawyers stopped doing, everybody, you know, that, I'm not saying the lawyers were, the pressures were such that it got harder to do the due diligence and other kind of things, and the pressures became bigger for capital, you know, make it easier to raise capital than protect shareholders.
So in terms of, I guess we might say, a cultural shock, at first it wouldn't have been so bad going over into private practice, but that,
right.
Yeah, but that really through time that,
well, and working
that
with,
evolved.
Working with Alan Levinson, I felt safe because I knew him and I knew where he stood, and I knew that we would not do anything that I was uncomfortable with, because he wouldn't do anything that he was in. I mean, and people he worked with were all people who had some association with the SEC or been, where they had learned that system of. But we weren't the only ones. I mean, that was pretty true for most of the securities. But I wish you could look back now and say it was a pretty insulated group, but sometimes there's some benefits to that.
Did he stay there the whole time that you were there, or did he eventually?
No, he
on?
Stayed there. He died 5 or 6 years ago, but he was there until he died.
Yeah. And you were there until 97?
I think it was 96.
96.
I'm thinking that I may have, that may not be quite right. I think I left in 96. There was an opportunity to go to the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, it's called now, I guess, which was as the head of their financial institutions group, not as a lawyer, but they produce a lot of reports at the request of Congress. It's a really interesting agency.
But you'd already been on Warren Rudman's committee at that point.
Yeah, that was just sort of an extracurricular event.
One didn't lead into the other.
No. I knew some people at GAO, and I was looking to go back into some sort of I was ready to try some public service again, because I didn't particularly like the direction that securities law was going, and I wasn't. It seemed like a good idea to try something different, and it was more of a management job, in a way. And I testified on the Hill on one of our reports about why there should be more regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That was fun. Nobody listened, but I enjoyed it. I was only there for about a year because I had some personal health issues, not for myself, but for family things, and it just got to be too much. So I decided it was time to go do something, take some time off, and see what else I was going to do.
Okay. We are interested in the Rudman Committee because we've been talking to a number of people at NASD, and so having the perspective on what was happening there in the 1990s would be useful.
Well, I don't remember a whole lot about the details. It was Rudman, by the way.
Rudman?
Yeah. The most of the work was done by the law firm. Rudman was of counsel to... I can't remember what the firm was. And it was a big project for his law firm. So a lot of the work was done by them. And it was mostly governance kind of work, trying to there had been issues. I mean, you probably know more about this than I do. I have a copy of the report, but
right, the odd eighths thing going on with quoting certain prices that would never come in at an odd eighth, so it increased the spread.
No. It was more whether it was appropriate to have the same entity govern both the market itself and also the participants in the market, because there was some sense that there was favoritism towards the bigger participants, and that impacted the governance of the... I don't remember what the specific issue was. I don't think that was that. I think it was a series of things. It could have been that.
Right.
I just don't remember.
I know that was one of the issues.
But it could have
the
been.
Idea was...
It could have been one of the issues.
Yeah. NASD wasn't exercising sufficient oversight.
Yes, yeah. And so what we focused on was governance aspects, basically separating the two.
NASD and NASDAQ.
Yeah, so that they didn't have that conflict. That was the main.
Right.
So it was really focused more on that kind of stuff than it was on specific issues of...
Right.
You know, what did people do wrong? It was more... You're going to get people doing the wrong thing if you have this governance thing, so let's think about how to do it where people can pay attention to what they need to pay attention to.
Right. And then the 21A report from the SEC was a little bit after that, actually. I may be pressing you too much on something that's not significant to you.
I just don't remember. Yeah, it wasn't the main thing I was working on. I was doing it. We spent a lot of time talking about it. I do remember the 21A report, but I don't remember the
right
timing.
Okay. So then, I don't know if there's anything else we should talk about with the GAO. Was that mainly then the mutual funds again?
No. It was all financial institutions. It was banks. Okay. Congress looked... My issues area covered the bank regulators, the securities regulators, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all the financial regulators in the government.
Okay.
Commodities, futures, exchange, you know, whatever.
Okay.
So, and the reports we did were members of Congress asked for reports, but also... The strength of the GAO is that it develops its own areas that it wants to look into. Kind of hope that a congressman might ask, but even if they don't, you still can do a report. And
so you oversaw the research and production of the reports?
Right. And my job was to be the one who testified about them when Congress wanted to.
Okay. We haven't actually spoken with many people who are at GAO, if any. I'm not sure.
I don't think you'll find very many. Unless you do the GAO instead of the SEC.
But we're interested in all aspects of regulation, so it's...
Well, the GAO consider itself a regulator.
Right.
They are an arm of Congress.
Right.
And although they have an audit function, they also oversee the audits of all the federal agencies. That's a separate part of it.
How big was the office or you're part of the organization?
Well, 70 people, maybe.
70?
Yeah. You know, there was an issues. They've changed the structure now, and I'm not sure what they're called now. Then they were called issue areas, and there was one for health and financial stuff, and education. I don't remember what they all were, but
right. And yours was the financial
institutions
and market issues.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Should we? I don't know if you want to cover anything after your departure from GAO. You may as well mention things that you've done.
Yeah, well, what I did start doing was being on the board of a group of mutual funds, which kept up that part of my background. But that's all. I haven't participated in other securities stuff so much, partly because I've just sort of it was so clear to me that we were going the wrong direction, and I was right, but I just get tired of it now because it's just
so just returning then one more time to the theme of women in regulation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you must have seen quite the overarching shift from the early period of the 60s and 70s into the 90s and the most recent decades.
Well, yeah, it wasn't just happening in regulation. It was happening everywhere.
In law. Across society.
Yeah. I had women lawyers friends who were of my age, of which there weren't that many of us, so we would get together a lot. One was Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the CFTC and who got a fair amount of publicity because she was the only member of some group that had the heads of all the financial things who said that derivatives had to be looked at. This is
everybody very
just shot her down, and there's been a lot of publicity about that because she was absolutely right, and everybody agrees she was right. And that was in the late 90s, I think. And I think there's not too much doubt that the fact that she was a woman probably didn't help her status-wise and in talking to the rest of the group. So things change, but not totally.
Right. Yeah, definitely at the level of public discourse. I mean, we've just seen Janet Yellen come in at the Fed as well.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, and she's been around long. It gets easier. The more women there are, the easier it gets to not have.
On the commission, Mary Shapiro and Elise Walters. And
yeah, in any organization. Yeah. I mean, there's even been some research done on boards of directors, and that you need to have a critical mass of women. You can't just have one. The pressures are just, no matter what. But if you have three, sort of, that's the good number to have. And you can just see that. You just need enough so that it stops being an issue.
It ceases to seem a novelty even when somebody does get to the top.
Yeah, it's just, but, and we, you know, we've advanced some, but not everywhere. But that's life.
Okay. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's been very interesting.